Welcome to Decision 2012, Illinois Public Media's live coverage of the 2012 primary election. I'm Craig Cohen. Over the next 3 hours, we'll bring you the latest results and analysis in the GOP presidential primary, the Democratic and Republican 13th congressional district primaries, plus races for state legislative and judicial seats, the Champaign County Board, Auditor, and Circuit Clerk, and we'll keep you posted on the results of referenda on today's ballot. Throughout the evening, I'll be joined in studio by Dr. Robert Rich, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We'll also be joined on the line by political science professors Kent Redfield from the University of Illinois at Springfield and John Jackson from SIU Carbondale. Also this hour, we'll check in with Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton at the Brookings Administrative Center. First, this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The Illinois primary is coming to a close with polls shutting down there at this hour. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports, although it was a beautiful weather day, turnout was low in Democratic areas and steady in Republican strongholds.
In the Democratic stronghold of Chicago and Cook County, officials say turnout is likely to be less than 25%. The reason, no presidential contest on the ticket. In Republican areas, a bit of a different story, like in New Trier Township, a suburban area north of Chicago. Herb Ritchell wouldn't say who he voted for in the Republican presidential contest, but did say the candidates should talk more about real issues.
The economy is a big deal, and I think we need to hear our candidates speak about foreign affairs. I haven't heard much about that.
Results of the voting will come slower tonight in a quarter of the counties in Illinois where ballots were too big to fit in scanning machines. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
A strong earthquake caused buildings to sway in Mexico City today and sent workers fleeing into the streets. There were reports of some damage, including a transit bridge falling onto an empty metro transit bus and some damage to homes and buildings. However, there are no reports of deaths or major injuries. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the 7.4 magnitude earthquake was centered 120 miles from the Pacific Coast Resort of Acapulco. The quake was felt as far away as Guatemala City. The Obama administration is blasting a budget proposal put forth today by Republican Congressman Paul Ryan. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the White House calls the plan unfair, unbalanced, and wrong for the U.S. economy.
Ryan's budget proposal would dramatically cut tax rates, especially for those at the top of the income ladder, while curbing social programs like Medicaid and college grants that primarily benefit the poor and middle class. White House spokesman Jay Carney says the plan amounts to a shift of money into the pockets of those who are already the most well off.
It is not a plan that this president could support, and it's not one that we think the American people would broadly support, because it's not right for the economy and it's not right for the vast majority of the American people.
The plan has zero chance of passing the Democratic-controlled Senate, but it could become a campaign tool for Republican lawmakers and presidential hopefuls. Scott Horsley, NPR News. The White House.
The Greek Parliament has signed off on a second international bailout deal. This one will provide the country with an additional $227 billion in exchange for more austerity measures and promises by bondholders to take less than their holdings are worth. Greece narrowly avoided a default this month after obtaining the latest loan, the second in 2 years, from other Eurozone members and the International Monetary Fund. Concerns of slowing growth in China, coupled with an earnings warning from giant heavy equipment maker Caterpillar, worried Wall Street today. The Dow was down 68 points to close at 13,170. The Nasdaq was down 4 points, ending the session at 3074. The S&P 500 fell 4 points as well. You're listening to NPR. New tariffs being imposed on solar panels made in China. That's after the Commerce Department says preliminary findings have determined the Chinese government improperly provided subsidies ranging from 3 to 4.75% to manufacturers of those panels. As a result, the U.S. government says it will impose tariffs of a similar amount on Chinese solar panels imported into the U.S. A report is warning the U.S. is facing an education crisis that is threatening both the economy and national security. NPR's Claudio Sanchez has more on the conclusions of the Council of Foreign Relations, a policy research group.
According to a 30-member committee led by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Joel Klein, former Chancellor of the New York City Public Schools, 75% of teenagers and young adults are physically and academically unfit for military service. Few speak a foreign language, and most lack the skills to fill the growing need for more scientists, aerospace technicians, and engineers. In language reminiscent of the 1983 report, Nation at Risk, that resulted in federal government-led school reforms, the committee warns that dominant power of the 21st century will depend on human capital. The failure to produce that capital will undermine American security. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
According to a tax analyst, the Obama administration's plan to up taxes for those earning more than $1 million a year, the so-called Buffett rule, would bring in about $31 billion over the next 11 years. A minuscule amount towards federal budget deficits expected to exceed $7 trillion. Proposal comes from an estimate by Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. Proposal calls for those earning at least $1 million annually to pay 30% of their income in taxes. The rule named for billionaire investor Warren Buffett, who has said that taxes on the wealthy aren't high enough. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.
This is special coverage of the 2012 Illinois primary from Illinois Public Media. I'm Craig Cohen. Later this hour, we'll hear from Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton at the Brookings Administrative Center. We'll also discuss the Republican presidential primary with our panel, and we'll have an update on election results statewide from Illinois Public Radio in Springfield. First, though, let me introduce our guests who will be with us throughout the evening. Dr. Robert Rich is Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Craig.
Glad to have you with us. Also with us on the line is Kent Redfield. He's a professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. Kent, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And John Jackson is professor of political science at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale and a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Policy Institute. John, welcome as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you all with us. And I want to start off by asking each of you, what races intrigue you most tonight? What should we care about most tonight? Let me start with Bob.
Well, clearly it's the presidential primary that is important. It's important because of how close the presidential race appears to be right now. And then in the statewide, in the state races, I'm particularly interested in the 13th congressional district, and in the Senate race for between Cultra and Berrickman, and also with Chapin Rose. I'm interested in those two races as well.
Kent, what piques your interest tonight?
Probably some of the congressional races that involve incumbents running against each other or former incumbents. I assume Jesse Jackson will win in the second, but that's been an interesting race. And we've got two sitting members of the House, Kutzinger and Manzullo, running against each other in the 16th. So, those are certainly interesting races. Some of the other races will kind of set the stage. Who are the Democrats going to nominate to run against Dolden the 10th? Who will the Democrats nominate to run against Walsh in the 8th? And so those are certainly, in addition to what the ones that Bob have mentioned, the 92nd or 96th here in Springfield is a new district. And then certainly the 10th legislative district up in House district up in Chicago. We will see whether or not the Democrats will nominate a legislature who was indicted last week for taking a bribe. So there's always an interesting wrinkle when you're looking at Illinois politics and elections.
I was going to say, Illinois politics is never boring. John, what interests you at this point tonight?
Well, of course, presidential election, but within that, I think the delegate count is going to be interesting. You have to keep an eye on it as well as the beauty contest, and perhaps it's a bit parochial, but in my end of the state, we have an interesting race for the 12th congressional district. Both sides have contested primary, although the one in the Democratic side is not that serious, but the one on the Republican side to run again in November is very serious, and that's an interesting race.
You mentioned the delegate count, and I want to talk some more about that later in the hour as we get into the presidential race in some detail, but I should point out for our listeners, there are 54 delegates at stake, plus 15 superdelegates, and we'll talk about what that's all about later in the hour as well. One of the major races that we are following tonight is one that you mentioned right up front, Bob, and that's the newly redrawn 13th Congressional District. How might redistricting affect tonight's results?
I actually think that the effect of redistricting is one of the most interesting aspects of the primary election and of the general election as well. And as Kent pointed out, we, as a consequence of redistricting, have Republicans, incumbent Republicans, running against themselves. We have new districts like the 13th, which goes all the way from Champaign all the way to the Mississippi River, as well. So we have these primary contests where incumbents are running against incumbents, Halverson and Jesse Jackson as well on the Democratic side, and that's mostly a function of the redistricting process. And on the presidential side, I'd say another really interesting aspect that's new this year is the role of the super PACs.
Right.
Because the super PACs allow for huge sums of money to be devoted to the presidential election.
Well, you know, I mean, this has been an especially nasty primary election season, particularly in the presidential nomination fight among the GOP. And one of the reasons for that may be those super PACs.
Indeed. And I think we have a great demonstration. Although people like to say we're not in favor of negative advertising, but it is nevertheless the case that it appears from this point in the election so far, the negative advertising appears to make a difference, sometimes only if to increase the turnout or to make people go to the polls. But negative advertising, unfortunately, appears to be effective.
Kent, when we think back to the Citizens United case and the question of whether money equals speech, is it fair to say we're seeing in practice the possibility that maybe money equals negative speech?
Well, I think that's true. The super, when you get independent expenditures, which is basically what we're talking about, they tend not to be tempered by the candidate's campaign. They tend to have a harder edge. And it is in many ways easier to craft a negative message than a positive message, and not mess up the campaign of the person you're trying to support. The candidate you're supporting is going to frame himself and define himself, but it doesn't. You know, if you tear down his opponent in ways that might be a little different than the way he might have or that your candidate might have, it doesn't have a negative impact on the campaign. What the other thing we're seeing here is when the court wrote the Citizens United, they were thinking in terms of multi-candidate independent expenditure committees and allowing corporate money to flow into those committees. And held the position that you could not have corruption if it was uncoordinated speech given, you know, in these kind of multi-candidate, broad-based political committees. And what we have seen in this election is the single candidate super committee. Every once in a while, one of the Republican candidates will misspeak. Romney has talked a couple of times about his super PAC, and they're supposed to be not non-coordinated independent entities. And so I think the court clearly did not foresee all of the implications of their rulings. And it's been a series of rulings. It's not just Citizens United.
In fact, any time we do hear from candidates talking about super PACs, it seems we commonly hear them say, well, I have no control over what the message may be of this outside entity. But if they were to talk about this or that, well, you know, that'd be up to them. You know, they sort of, Bob, sort of just in a way coordinate through the media while not coordinating officially.
Yeah, I think that the super PACs are playing an important role in the primary election so far. And you're right. If I listen to Governor Romney or Senator Santorum or Speaker Gingrich, they'll maintain that they don't control what the super PAC says or does. But if you compare the messages of the super PACs putting out with the message the campaign is putting out, there's a pretty high correlation. Or give you another one. I've been surprised during this primary campaign just how many robocalls that I've gotten. I was working at home yesterday afternoon and got six of them.
Wow.
Four from the Romney campaign, two from the Santorum campaign, but actually it was divided between the campaign and the super PAC.
Go ahead, John.
I think what we're going to see in Illinois as an extension of that is that the analogy with both Michigan and Ohio, in the big states, money makes a difference because you've got to be on television, and Romney's just had so much more money than the others that there's just not a contest in the sense of his television expenditures are reported somewhere between 10 to 1 up to about 18 to 1. I don't know the exact number over Santorum, and that's what prevailed in Michigan, particularly in the urban areas, and that's what prevailed in Ohio and probably will prevail tonight.
How have third-party ads, super PAC ads, Kent, impacted the behavior of the candidates themselves?
Generally, it allows the candidates to focus on positive, defining themselves as a candidate, and let the independent expenditures carry the heavy lifting. Now, there certainly are cases where things will be done by an independent group that's more independent than the candidate would like and can throw campaigns off message. But as long as you have the heavy lifting or the dirty work done by the super PAC, it allows you to present a much more, to focus on defining yourself, to doing the ground war and doing the media events in ways that you don't have to kind of jump back and forth between an attacker and someone who's laying out their positive vision for what's going on. So you can, done right and correctly, you can compartmentalize, and it makes for a more effective campaign.
That's go ahead.
Craig, I must say, I'm somewhat puzzled by the notion, which I keep hearing over and over again, that Governor Romney has done something wrong by spending as much money as he has, and that it's unfair that he's outspent his competitors and the like. I find that curious because I think that allocation of resources is exactly what our political system right now is designed to do. And so whereas I might find it distasteful of just how much money is being spent, I don't think that Governor Romney is particularly doing something wrong, or that I don't also buy the notion that it would be a much closer race if he didn't have the resources that he did.
And it may not be so much about how much money is spent by a given candidate, but sometimes it's how it's spent. And I want to share for you an example of one attack ad that did come from a campaign directly itself. This is an attack ad against 51st Senate candidate Tom Plura, released by the campaign of his challenger, Chapin Rose. Let's listen to it and then want to talk about it.
Seen this guy Tom Plura's commercials with the chickens? What's up with that?
He won't debate me.
False. They debated two times and two more are scheduled. Plura says he's a doctor, but spends a heck of a lot of time suing hospitals. Plura claims he's not an insider, but he gave $80,000 to politicians. And Plura calls himself a Republican, but admits he contributed to Dick Durbin and front groups for Nancy Pelosi. So what about Plura and his chickens? Well, take them with a grain of salt.
All right, so that's fairly extreme. I guess you could see just on its own certainly a clear attack sort of ad. And I'm curious what you all thought of the idea of a campaign specifically doing that in an election season where there seem to be so many outside entities willing to be the attack dogs for given campaigns.
Well, this particular race has turned out to be, I think, particularly nasty. And it's been nasty both in the public arena and behind the scenes as well. So I must say it doesn't surprise me. I suspect that particular race has had more money devoted to it than many other legislative races.
Let's move on to a couple other quick topics. We've been through a period of sort of anti-incumbency sentiment in just the last few years, giving rise to the Tea Party, among other movements. John, what impact might the sort of throw the bums out contingent have tonight?
Well, it has some possible effect in this end of the state. The Tea Party has some presence, and I think they certainly exhibit that attitude. The problem is they haven't been able to coalesce on a single candidate that is their candidate for throwing, you know, whoever out. For example, in terms of the 12th District Republicans, it's not clear whether it's Plummer or Carmose or Cook that benefits from that attitude. They're all in favor of not replacing Costello with another Democrat. So it's a little unclear just how they will come down in a number of these races.
Kent, voter turnout, at least here in Champaign-Urbana, was expected to be lighter than usual due to spring break for many schools, including the university. How might a lighter turnout across the state impact the results?
The intensity of your supporters has an impact on turnout, and so to use an example, you would assume a diehard Ron Paul supporter is going to make it regardless of what else is going on. So just like caucus activities tend to favor more intensity in terms of the supporters, then it probably plays a little bit in Santorum's favor if there's more enthusiasm there than perhaps in the Romney camp. But it also gives an advantage to organizational, either within a campaign, Romney has a good organization, and then county organizations. So we're looking at state races and local races, and these are the primary is where county organizations can really make a difference all the way up and down the ballot, because they can deliver a certain amount of vote and can be more effective, frankly, than in the general election, where there are lots of other factors driving turnout.
Let me ask this, Bob. Does it benefit or hurt candidates at either end of the political spectrum when there's lighter voter turnout, do you think?
I don't think it's a issue of the political spectrum. I think Kent's right. I think it's an issue of intensity, of how committed you are to your candidate. And then also, I think of, as also Kent reflected, of organization. I think one of Governor Romney's tasks in Illinois this time around has been to try to turn the voters out, especially in suburban Chicago, where he presumably has his greatest strength.
We were talking before about the impact of redistricting on tonight's results, and I'm kind of curious, I think, on two levels, how it impacts the newly drawn map on the makeup of Illinois' congressional contingent, and then also how redistricting might impact the Illinois legislature.
Well, let's take the Illinois legislature. I think what's happened, as you know, is that the Democrats controlled the drawing of the map, both the state map and the congressional map, and they drew districts which were going to try to get Republican incumbents to have to run against each other. And so it's made for a primary race for people running against each other who didn't plan to run against each other, and some people who switched from a representative to try to run for the Senate as well as a result of the redistricting. As far as the congressional races go, we have one fewer congressional seat in Illinois, and then the drawing of the district lines also affected races like the Halverson, Jesse Jackson race, because he's now having to run in areas where he's never run before.
Let's leave it there for now. I want to bring in Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton, who's on the line from the Brookings Administrative Center. We've been talking, Gordy, about the expected lighter turnout today due to spring break for Champaign-Urbana schools in the U of I. Has that been the case? Do you know? Can you tell us?
I think it's a little too early for us to tell. We exceeded our 2008 primary turnout in terms of early and absentee voting here at the Brookings Center. And I'm hoping the nice weather today actually impacted polling place turnout in a positive way and sort of counteracts the negative impact of spring break.
How quickly might we expect to see results in the presidential race, the 13th congressional race, and in the other local legislative and judicial races, or legislative races, rather?
Vote counting is going to be impacted more slowly because we have write-in candidates on the ballot in every polling place in Champaign County. And as you know, write-in votes have to be tallied at the polling place by election judges by hand.
Were there any problems at the polls today, at least for Champaign County?
Things went very smoothly. We always have contingency plans for, you know, a ballot box that won't unlock here or a tabulator that won't boot there. We had a handful of those minor issues this morning, nothing that impacted any voters. Voters were able to show up, get their ballots, vote in privacy, and go on with their day.
Now, there were, I understand, 25 counties across the state, including some in central Illinois, that had ballots that were too large and didn't fit into scanning machines. How does something like that happen?
There are a number of counties, thankfully not us, who outsource their ballot printing and in some cases their ballot design to vendors. This is the first election where we've printed all of Champaign County's ballots in-house. So we were able to design our own ballots, print them all in-house. We saved about $10,000 for county taxpayers by doing that. And that also gives us the ability to test and retest ballots at any time and have absolute control over the custody of the ballots and the quality of the ballots.
And in the case of those other counties where maybe they outsource that stuff, do they not get a chance to see the ballots and test them with the scanning machines prior to Election Day?
They probably had the opportunity, and I don't want to speak for my fellow election authorities in other jurisdictions. They probably had the opportunity, but they had tested perhaps a previously delivered test deck that had been printed on correct size paper.
Okay. What's your role on the night of a primary election? What are you doing?
I am talking with election judges as they are closing down their polling places to make sure there are no issues. And then we are proofing and double checking all of our results, make sure that we haven't missed anything, make sure that we've correctly added in the early and absentee vote totals before we release the unofficial results here at Brookings to the candidates and to the media.
Give us a sense of the activity that takes place at Brookings. I mean, there was a time when reporters would sort of huddle over printouts of results as they came in. There was a sort of a cacophony of sound. Is that kind of still how things work?
That's still how things work. I'd like to think we're a little better organized than that now, but we still have media. In fact, I think media are the only folks that are here right now. Candidates will probably start showing up in 45 minutes or an hour or something like that. And there's still a sense of excitement and there's still a little bit of a scramble when we bring in a new county summary with unofficial results.
What do you personally enjoy most about election nights?
I personally enjoy the satisfaction that our team of election judges and staff have worked months to put this day together, and we can release unofficial results that are an accurate and true reflection of the will of Champaign County's voters.
All right. So what do you least enjoy?
We've been at work since 4 o'clock this morning.
I had a feeling you might say that.
It's a long day.
Yeah.
And the afternoon, believe it or not, gets a little monotonous, because we've addressed any issues that have happened and the afternoon turnout has slowed down a little bit and we're sort of anticipating the close of the polls, but there's not a lot happening from, say, 3 to 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
All right, now you need to get back to dealing with those ballots and results, so we'll let you get to it. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Holton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You are listening to live election coverage from Illinois Public Media, WILL, and online at WILL.illinois.edu. And thanks so much for joining us, and we will continue with our conversations here as we'll talk in just the next little while about the Republican presidential primary with our panelists. We'll have some other results and analysis for you ahead. So stay with us right here on Illinois Public Media. We'll be right back.
and good evening. This is primary election coverage from Illinois Public Radio. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Professor Kent Redfield from the University of Illinois Springfield. Exit polling suggests Mitt Romney leading rival Rick Santorum in the Illinois Republican primary. In Illinois, as in Michigan and Ohio, Romney enjoyed an enormous advantage in TV advertising. His campaign and Restore Our Future, a super PAC that supports him, outspent Santorum in the state and his super PAC by nearly $3.5 million to $500,000. That's an advantage of 7-1. The polls have been closed for about a half an hour now. We're also watching tonight some congressional and legislative races, as well as others around the state. And let me bring Kent Redfield in. Professor Redfield, just mentioning the numbers that we talked about when it comes to spending, Mitt Romney certainly had a big advantage, and that may pay off for him. That may be what puts him over the top in Illinois.
Yes, money is intensely important when you're trying to communicate with a state the size of Illinois. That money is also important, not just on the, you know, that represents what they spend on ads, but the organizational money is very important. You know, Romney has a full slate of delegates. Santorum does not. Romney has a lot of connections with organizational, party organizations throughout the state that are going to help him with get out the vote kinds of activities. And so that's a huge advantage, not only in terms of getting the message out, but also getting voters to the polls.
Exit polling from the Associated Press was also saying that most of the Republican voters going were pretty pessimistic about the economy, and the economy was a key issue for them. That has to also help Romney. I mean, when Rick Santorum is talking about running on various social issues, Romney really has pushed the economy, and that may also help him tonight.
No, I think there's no question about that. And Santorum has, in trying to appeal to the social conservatives and try to get that narrative about how this is all related to culture, has seemed to downplay fixing the economy. I mean, he walked those statements back, but essentially said, you know, we really need to fix society and the family, and then the economy will follow. And that's probably not a great message for someone who's looking for someone to come in and create jobs and get me back to work. So I think that's going to play very well, particularly in suburban areas. Downstate, Santorum still should have lots of strength in terms of more ideologically conservative voters.
Now, will the outcome of the presidential race here in Illinois, will that show up in some of these congressional races, especially those suburban races, many of them very hotly contested up there, the Manzullo-Kinzinger race for one? Could that impact people coming out voting for Mitt Romney over Santorum? Would that help a certain candidate there?
I'm not sure there's going to be an advantage. They will feed off of each other. The Manzullo-Kinzinger race has kind of been defined old conservative, new conservative, and so the presidential will help the congressional will help the presidential. If you would have had, say, a Walsh running against a more moderate Republican, the primary still going on would have had an effect. But it will help turnout, but it's not clear that it's going to have an impact favoring one of the candidates over the other.
And turnout in Illinois apparently ranging from pretty low in Democratic areas, it appears, to steady in a lot of Republican strongholds. DuPage County, according to reports, their final turnout could be as high as 40%, and that would just be a slight drop from what it was in 2008 when it was 44%. Wow. Also today, nearly a quarter of Illinois counties grappled with some problems with primary ballots that were too large to fit into scanning machines. That glitch could slow down some vote counting in areas tonight. We'll have to find out if that does prove to be the case. The problem did not originate directly with two companies supplying the voting systems, but with a graphics company that printed the ballots. That's according to Rupert Borgsmiller with the Illinois State Board of Elections. He says he did not know how many ballots were affected, but says the problem affected 25 counties and also the city of Aurora. We'll be following the numbers tonight. Again, exit polling showing that Mitt Romney is leading his rival Rick Santorum in the Republican primary in Illinois. We'll follow other results as they become available this evening here on Illinois Public Radio.
One of the reasons it's so important to nominate a Republican to be president that can beat President Obama is so we can stop Obamacare, and so senators and congressmen across the country that are conservative will also get elected. If we have that group together, then I can finally have action to repeal it.
You're starting to see inflation tick up. And of course, we know what the value of the dollar has been. This president is putting us on a very slippery slope, one that has a weak dollar, a weak economy, weak energy policy, and of course, a pathetically weak foreign policy.
We have to go back to being an America that has big dreams and then liberates the American people to chase the dreams. If we do that, the young people who are here will be in the most dynamic, the most exciting country in the world, and you will be astonished at how much you achieve in your lifetime.
We're supposed to occupy countries and get involved and go into nation building. That is not in the Constitution. It spends a lot of money, and it doesn't help us in national defense. It actually makes us less defensible because we don't ever want to equate military spending with defense spending.
Highlights from the four Republican presidential candidates stumping for votes in recent days here in Illinois, where 54 delegates and 15 superdelegates are at stake. This is Decision 2012, Illinois Public Media's live coverage of the 2012 primary election. I'm Craig Cohen, joined once again by Bob Rich, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, Kent Redfield, professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Springfield, and John Jackson, professor of political science at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. He's a visiting professor from the Paul Simon Policy Institute. We're going to talk some more now about the GOP presidential race with our panel. I want to start with John. Is there anything any of the candidates have said in recent days that have specifically resonated with Illinois voters, you think? Or is it just that they sort of did a quick fly-in and fly-out because of the primary calendar?
Well, I think probably the person who's played it best has been Romney, because he has stressed the economy, and everyone knows that it comes out on top in terms of the polls. I think the flip side of that is who played it most badly, and I think even Santorum now realizes that his downplaying the economy and upplaying the social issues in that quote yesterday probably hurt him, and that's why he backpedaled on it. And added to that was what I think is clearly a real snafu in the Puerto Rican primary, both in terms of the hours spent there as well as the admonition that they all had to learn English, goes down in the annals of bad judgment case studies.
Bob, you're nodding. I take it you agree.
Yeah, I couldn't add anything to what John says. I think that Romney correctly knows that Illinois voters, like many Midwestern voters, like many American voters, care the most about the Illinois economy, about the unemployment rate, about the deficit, the growing deficit. That's been Governor Romney's theme all along, that he knows how to manage an economy and can and will do that. And he's characterized Senator Santorum as lightweight on the economic issues, and I think the snafu yesterday, and I don't care about unemployment, help feed into that image.
Kent, would you characterize the headline of the Illinois presidential race, the race for these delegates, as being a Santorum misstep?
Well, yeah, I think it's a job. You know, Romney is talking jobs now, and that's very important. And if you put Santorum's statements in context, I mean, his broad theme is that you need to fix the family, you need to fix society, and you've got to get at the core problems, and the rest of this is all, symptomatic. That's all well and good if you're trying to lay out a 10-year plan. If you're trying to win an election on Tuesday, I think you should probably talk to voters more directly about what their primary concerns are.
I want to talk just a little bit about some of the nuts and bolts here. I mentioned the fact that there are 54 delegates at stake, but also 15 superdelegates. Bob, these are made up of party officials, sometimes it's senior office holders, sort of the traditional what you might characterize as sort of the classic insider Republican entrenched group.
What Speaker Gingrich likes to call the Republican establishment.
There you go. That's a good word for it. And so I'm wondering if you think one of the candidates benefits specifically from the fact that such superdelegates exist.
I think that part of the strategy for all of the candidates is to try to win the support of the superdelegates, and most of them up to this point in time are uncommitted. And I think that they're uncommitted because, as they were in 2008 with Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, many of them were uncommitted. They want to be persuaded as to who stands the best chance of winning in the general election.
Kent, also, is there a certain amount of theater at play here where the superdelegates want to wait and coalesce around a candidate as the convention rolls around, or at least in advance of it, if not during?
There certainly is some of that. They are, these are the party elders, and the idea is that they will provide kind of a leavening and a more reasoned kind of assessment about who the party should nominate and where it should go. This is really goes back to 1968 and 1972, when you had the 1972 convention that the Democrats threw out large delegations, one of them being from the city of Chicago, headed by Mayor Daley. And they have tried to build more party organization back into the process of both the Democrats and Republicans. And so these are people who are not persuaded, or the assumption is they're not persuaded by the emotion of the moment, and will give a more reasoned judgment. Are there drama queens involved with this? Certainly.
John, go ahead, John.
I agree with all that, but let me add, given the number of high-profile Republicans who've endorsed Romney, and I think of only one fairly high-profile, Tim Johnson, endorsed Ron Paul, I would expect most of those people ultimately would favor Romney. It would take something fairly startling to get very many other than Romney out of that group of 15 when they're chosen. I think the party convention actually chooses 12 of those 15, and it won't even meet till June. But nevertheless, the likelihood is Romney will be advantaged by them.
John, I'm wondering, Kent mentioned 68 and 72, and certainly pundits across the cable news net spectrum were in a lather over the last week talking about the possibility of a split convention and multiple ballots. Do you see any possibility that we could see a repeat of something like that from 68 and 72?
Well, it's vaguely and theoretically possible, but highly unlikely. I think this will be over before the convention, and everybody occasionally at this point gets to talking about a brokered convention. It was noised about in Clinton versus Obama in the last one, but it's just not likely to happen. It's going to be wrapped up by committed delegates and somebody, presumably Romney, getting over that magic number of 1144.
I mean, so far the party elders have also all indicated that they don't want a brokered convention. Chairman of the Republican National Party has said that one of these four will have enough delegates at the time. I think conventional wisdom at this point is it might last until June, might go all the way to California before it occurs. But over the last couple of days, there's been a lot of the so-called delegate math. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming over here tonight. I heard some of the most recent delegate math, which says that all as Governor Romney has to do is on average win 49% of the delegates available between now and June in order to win, whereas Senator Santorum would have to win over 70% of the delegates in order to clinch the nomination.
But didn't we also hear this around this time 4 years ago from the Clinton campaign, when they got out to an early lead in delegates? They started talking about inevitability and people sort of looked askew at that term. Was it because it was so much earlier in the delegate count at the time?
I think Governor Romney is backing off somewhat of the inevitability, I think wisely backing off of the inevitability notion. I think what he's trying to say, I think correctly, is that it's mathematically unlikely that he's not going to have the nomination clinched. And moreover, if you really look at the polling numbers, what's interesting is almost all the polling numbers indicate that among Republicans, they believe that Romney has the best chance of defeating President Obama as well. Even to some degree, those who support Representative Paul and Senator Santorum, even they to some extent believe that Governor Romney is the one who can most likely defeat President Obama.
An extension of that thought is that if it were to come to a brokered convention, it would be disastrous for the Republicans, and I think most of the party elders think that, and there's no way they're going to emerge with a new and different candidate, and there's no way they could emerge without their candidate being scarred.
But, you know, if you were to have a split convention, might not the novelty of such an event actually create sort of a sense of excitement around the eventual GOP nominee?
It'd be great fun, but I don't think it would be good for the party in November.
Yeah, for Kent and John and I, who are political scientists, great fun. But I think it would be not good for the Republican Party.
Yeah, but for the average voter or sometimes voter who doesn't engage politics, then the idea that we went through all of these elections and then a bunch of officials and delegates got together and changed their mind and canceled out all of those votes would I think that's just, like you say, disastrous. And I don't know how far we have to go back to kind of get to a really brokered convention. If it was, in fact, Wendell Willkie and the crowd chanting, "We want Willkie," we know how well that turned out. So I just think it's not going to happen.
Let me stop our conversation for just a moment, because we do have the official word, and I think this will not come as a great surprise. Mitt Romney has won the Illinois Republican presidential primary, besting Rick Santorum. Exit poll results show Mr. Romney was preferred by Illinois primary goers, who said the economy was the top issue in the campaign. Former Massachusetts governor also was overwhelmingly favored, of course, by those who said an ability to defeat President Barack Obama was the quality they most wanted in a GOP nominee. So the official word we're receiving now via the Associated Press is that Mitt Romney has, in fact, won the Illinois Republican presidential primary. Not, I guess, a great surprise there.
Not at all. I mean, I think that a couple of weeks ago, that even 10 days ago, the polling numbers showed a more narrow race. But in the last couple of days, the polling numbers have been double digits for Romney, and I think part of that is what we talked about before, Craig, is the Santorum missteps on the economy.
So, Kent, if Romney winning the Illinois primary is not a surprise, what has surprised you about the presidential race so far this year?
Certainly the volatility. It is, and whether that's the Republicans' perspective is certainly that, you know, we've got a great bunch of candidates, and there certainly is a dissenting opinion that says these really aren't a great set of candidates, and that's why one is up one week and one the other. And so I think the volatility, the inability of people with when they get in a position to solidify whatever momentum they have, the fact that they pretty consistently have fallen back. I mean, this is on after Romney did really poorly in two Southern primaries. Now we have him doing well in Illinois, which would suggest that Illinois voters are probably pretty Illinois Republican voters are still pretty pragmatic, and that the it hasn't shifted as far to the right as perhaps some people had thought.
John, do you think the victory tonight for Romney here in Illinois in any way moves him closer to this notion of sealing the deal with Republican voters through the rest of the primary season?
Yes, absolutely. For the reasons that Bob Rich was talking about earlier, this is a nest of 54 delegates he'll get the lion's share of tonight, and I think it's going to be looked on as one of the crucial, perhaps, tipping points in this whole long marathon. Obviously, we go to Louisiana next, and obviously Santorum has a lot better chance there, but Illinois is going to be a very important story in this whole scenario.
Is there a path to a nomination for Santorum or Gingrich at this point?
I think not for Gingrich and a long shot for Santorum. He's got to have lightning strike somewhere unexpectedly, and Louisiana can help. And then, of course, he's got a long slog to where he gets to some more friendly territory.
When you look at the geography of what comes next, after Louisiana, we have Maryland, D.C., Pennsylvania, New York.
Likely very friendly for Romney.
And most of those are West Virginia. I think West Virginia may be friendly to Santorum, but I think most of these are very friendly to Romney. You asked before about surprises. I'm not so sure I want to say surprise, but what I find so interesting is what appears to be the competition for what you might say is the heart and soul of the Republican Party. And I think it's a real battle between the more conservative, more far right wing part of the party versus the more moderate part of the party.
Well, I'm glad you raised that. And actually, let me bring Kent back into this part of the discussion. When we talk about the soul of the Republican Party, what impact has the rise of the Tea Party had? That movement on presidential primary politics this year, and where that soul may be moving?
Well, if you think of the Tea Party as primarily fiscal, which I'm not sure that's 100% accurate, then towards more fiscal conservatism and a much more kind of hardline approach to government, to public finance. But there is kind of a strange marriage here between the fiscal conservatism and then the social conservatism and the evangelical Christian part of the Republican Party, and you've had some crossover in terms of that. So I don't think this is settled by any stretch of the imagination, because Romney is not running as the reincarnation of John Rockefeller. Romney has trimmed a whole bunch of positions that he took when he was running for governor of Massachusetts, that he's now on the opposite sides of those issues. And so, we can talk about a more moderate victory in terms of the way Romney will present himself, but that may be winning the battle while losing the war, as the whole of the Republican Party has shifted much more to the right than has historically been the case, or has been the case for the last 20 years. I guess that's maybe a better way to put it.
An extension of that thought is the rhetoric is certainly more extreme and more pure, I think. Think about George W. Bush, who called himself a compassionate conservative and got kudos for that, and I think it helped him in the general election, as opposed to Romney, who called himself a severe conservative when he ran Massachusetts. I think that's, to some extent, attributable to the presence of the Tea Party, not entirely the only factor, but one of them.
Well, and some of that is also just the when you have a serious primary challenge, don't you just see the rhetoric advance and sort of move to the extreme through the primary season and then shift back towards the center in the general election?
I think it's been more extreme this year than previous years, and George Bush had a pretty good challenge out of John McCain, at least at first, and he managed not to do himself that much damage.
Two thoughts. One of them is when John McCain ran in 2008, it wasn't the same John McCain who ran in 2000.
Right.
It was a far less moderate John McCain, witness not the least of which who he nominated for vice president. But I think the other really interesting aspect of this presidential election, Craig, is the number of the movement for anybody but Romney and how much strength that's had up to to now. And I think Romney's challenge, Governor Romney's challenge after Illinois tonight is going to be, can he get away from this notion that 60% of Republicans have voted for somebody else besides him? You know, can he get over that hump of people being more enthusiastic about him?
But one of the interesting aspects of that is how that 67% has voted at times for different candidates. So it's been like a little audition period for each of these candidates, some of whom have since dropped out of the race, some of whom remain, but none of whom have really developed any sort of coalescing energy around them.
No, the coalescing energy has been the, and if you're a Governor Romney strategist, which I'm not, but if you were, you worry about what that indicates is that there's strength to the anybody but Romney notion. Again, I think his biggest challenge now beyond Illinois is going to be to see whether he can coalesce a larger group of people and have them have more enthusiasm for him.
John Jackson, Governor Romney or any of the other candidates, would any of these folks have had a serious shot at the nomination if this were 2008 or 1996 or any other recent presidential year when the Republican nomination was up for grabs?
Well, I certainly think Romney would have. He is the archetypical, and he represents the standard that Republicans always look for. They look for someone who's run before, who did reasonably well but didn't win last time usually. He's got all the earmarks of someone that was most likely to win the thing going in, and I think he would have been competitive. Ron Paul, of course, is always there in this third or fourth time around, but he's at 10% there. The others, I think, are a little more surprising, but they're always surprising candidates. It's hard to say that a Herman Cain, for example, would have had a realistic shot in some of those earlier races.
You mentioned Ron Paul, and I don't want to give him short shrift because he has been in the campaign a few times. He has built up some energy around him, not just from people that maybe traditionally characterizing themselves as part of the Republican Party, but really as an outsider candidate this time running it within that party. What is the role of a Ron Paul in a primary election campaign from this point forward?
I think Ron Paul has even surprised himself to some degree in this campaign in the level of intensity and enthusiasm that he's generated, especially among the under 30 population. And if you're David Axelrod and running President Obama's campaign, the intensity of feeling, the passion of the under 30 folks and some independents for Paul has to worry you for the general election, because it's that under 30 population and independents who were so important for then Senator Obama, now President Obama. So I think it's the level of enthusiasm and intensity that the Paul supporters have that's so interesting.
Well, 2008 was such, there was such a distinction generationally speaking. You could see a divide there in how different generations, different age groups responded to the candidates. Do you think we're going to see the same thing again this year?
It really depends on how things look in the fall in terms of Obama being able to rekindle that coalition, and how much co-opting there is in terms of the things that played well that either campaign might try to pick up on in terms of the candidates that didn't win. It is, Paul is interested in building a movement and elections 4 years and 8 years from now. And whether that whether you can build that movement or whether it gets co-opted by mainstream political parties. The two political parties have shown some real ability over hundreds of years to pick up on things that are popular and fold them back in.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for now. John, Kent, Bob, we'll talk some more with you in the coming hours. You're listening to live election coverage from Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 8 o'clock.